It is my pleasure to introduce to you Rebecca Kiesling, attorney and pro-life speaker, who was conceived in rape. Her topic is, how should we defend the child conceived in rape or incest?
Very glad to be here this morning. I was adopted, and at 18, I began my search, and that is when I learned that I was conceived when my birth mother was raped. And I instantly felt targeted and devalued. I instantly thought of what people say, that I'm pro-life. Well, except in cases of rape. Or I'm pro-choice, especially in cases of rape. And I realized that all those people were talking about me, about my life. And I felt like I had at least half the world against me. I later learned a year and a half ago, a Gallup poll showed that of self-professing pro-lifers, 60% make the rape exception. So I had more than half of pro-lifers against me. And I felt like I would now have to justify my own existence, that I was going to have to prove myself to the world that I shouldn't have been aborted and that I was worthy of living. I asked my father and my mom about how they felt about abortion and in cases of rape. As soon as I learned, I asked them, and this was a secular Jewish home that I was raised in. My dad was a professor, and he said to me, well, I've always felt like, you know, it should be a woman's right to choose. I mean, who am I to say what a woman can or cannot do with her body? And I said to him, but Dad, you've witnessed my entire life, 18 years, you've seen me grow up. I mean, do you really believe that my birth mother's right to decide what could happen to her body for the 8 months from the time she found out she was pregnant, that her body was more important than my whole life? Really, Dad? You really believe that? And he instantly snapped out of it. And he said, well, wait a second. No, I don't believe that. And he said, wow, how would I ever get to a point where I would believe such a thing? And he started to talk about how, as a professor on campus, it was just expected that if you were progressive-minded, that you would be pro-choice. And he had just never really thought about it before, and he instantly changed. And so I learned immediately that my story was powerful and that it did have the ability to change hearts and minds. But at that time, I still really didn't know my own worth. I went ahead and kept trying to pursue being able to meet my birth mother. I really wanted to hear that maybe there was some mistake, that this was not how I was conceived. I wanted to hear that abortion wasn't an issue. So I ended up being one of the first people in Michigan to have a judge allow my caseworker to try to contact my birth mother and see if she wanted to meet me. And it worked. I finally received a letter with my name, which was Judy Ann Miracle. So I was a miracle baby. I thought that was kind of cool. And it had her name, Joanne, with her phone number, trembling. I called her up, and she said that she was sorry to hear that I already knew. But then she proceeded to fill me in on some horrific details that I was totally unequipped to hear. She's 4'10". She weighed 90 pounds. Really petite, a single mom heading to the grocery store at night right down the street from her home, and the guy jumped out of the bushes with a knife. And basically she went on to describe for me in graphic detail how he brutally raped her. And that's how I was conceived. And that was so hard to hear for several reasons. First of all, to think that I was conceived out of a truly worse case scenario. I just felt totally worthless, like garbage, because of people who would say that my life was like garbage, that I was disposable. And then I had to realize that my biological father was a really bad man. She said she had gone to several police lineups and stopped going because she wouldn't recognize his face, but that they knew that this was a serial rapist. And then all these years, I had really dreamed so much of meeting her. I had written poetry about meeting her. And so to hear that she had been violated like this really pained me. We arranged for me to fly home and meet her on her 51st birth date. In the meantime, she sent me photos and a letter. And she wrote, "My dearest Rebecca, hoping by now that the shock of finding out all the details of your birth are forgotten. For that was not reason enough of having to give up something as beautiful as you were. Nothing as precious as a baby. Mostly when you go through the 9 months and the birth all alone, feeling like no one loves you. But you were so perfect and pretty. All these years, I had nothing of you, nothing saying you were part of me. Just the memory of carrying a baby that I hoped one day would try to find her real mother as I always wanted to know my baby. You were always with me, my thoughts. You were always with me, my heart, mostly in July. It seems like a lifetime, I know. When I was sick 2 years ago, I thought I would never get to know my little girl. Would you please, Stephen, get me a copy of the letter you sent to the Oakland County judge? It made me cry. Also, I would like copies of your poems. These are things I would like to read. It's been a long 3 weeks looking forward to our meeting. I didn't know how to express my inner feelings. And she put in caps, "It's so great, big, beautiful. It's always been my dream. I am so happy. I'm crying." And she wrote in closing, "A love that ate at me for 19 years. My daughter at last. With love, your mom, Joanne." Oh, that was just all my dreams come true. I felt so affirmed. And I felt like, yes, I was wanted. Flew home, had a wonderful reunion weekend with her. The next day, she had a huge family reunion for me. I got to meet my half-brother, which was really weird to think we could have grown up together. 6 years later, I met my half-sister when I flew to Florida for a five-generation photo. It was the fourth time in a row that they had five generations of women alive. I got to room with my grandmother at the time, which was so cool. But after this initial reunion weekend, I flew back to college, went to a few meetings of Students for Life. I didn't get involved at that point because I didn't feel like I fit in anywhere. I was making horrible choices in my life. But it gave me the courage and support I felt I needed to finally call her and ask her about abortion, because I still needed to know. And she told me that if abortion had been legal in Michigan at the time, that she would have aborted me. And I said, "Well, you don't mean if you had to do it all over again, right?" And she said, "No." "Well, what about everything you said in that letter?" And she told me, "You don't know what it was like." And I know that that's true. But I also know that today, she's okay. In fact, she's doing great. She has a wonderful husband, a beautiful home, and despite the utter horror of her saying that to me, I still chose to nurture a relationship with her, to honor her for the role that she did play in my life. And frankly, I just thought that if I was good enough, that she'd change her mind. Well, by the time she did change her mind about abortion 6 years later, I was at a really good place in my life, knowing my value and identity in Christ, where I no longer needed to hear that for my own well-being, but it was still great to hear. I was with her when she was making baby clothes for my niece in Florida, who was in an unplanned pregnancy with her first great-grandchild. She said to me, "You know, I'm really glad she decided to have this baby, and I've changed my mind about all that." 2 days later, Norma McCorvey, Jane Roe, announced the very same thing to the nation, that she had changed her mind about abortion after years of having worked in an abortion clinic, yet never actually having had one herself. And how nice that she can do that, change her mind, and still have the opportunity to enjoy a relationship with her daughter from that case. What about the millions of women since, for whom changing their mind is the very painful realization that they will never have that opportunity here on earth? Now, her daughter is around my age. People forget that she had a daughter, not some fictitious, theoretical, philosophical, legal entity called a fetus, but a real person, and a woman no less. Don't ever let people forget that we are talking about real people, especially in the case of Roe versus Wade. Now, the trial date in Texas is in a footnote of the U.S. Supreme Court's opinion. I gasped the first time I read it. I was born July 22, 1969. The trial date was May 22, 1970. The Supreme Court decision was exactly 3.5 years to my birth date. So I just barely made it. And so did her daughter. This issue came up quite a bit in law school. I'd share a little how I was conceived and explain the truth that whenever you identify yourself as being pro-choice, or when you make that exception for rape, that really translates into you being able to stand before me, look me in the eyes, and say to me, I think that your mother should have been able to abort you. That's a pretty powerful statement. And I would never say anything like that to someone. I would never say to someone, if I had my way, you'd be dead. And it hurts, but I understand that people don't put a face to this issue. For most, it's just a concept, a quick cliche they sweep under the rug and forget about it. And I do hope that my story and the dozens of other life-affirming stories on my website of others conceived in rape or incest, women who became pregnant by rape and either regret aborting, raising their child, placed for adoption, that we can all help to put faces, voices, stories to this issue. Well, some people would reply to me by saying, well, I'm not saying that I think that your mother should have aborted you. I'm just saying I think it should have been her choice. Yeah, but her choice was to abort me. You don't really know that. No, I do know that. How can you really know something like that? Because she told me. Well, maybe she might not have, but she said she would have. And it's like, wait a second, this thing you say you believe in, why all of a sudden now are you so uncomfortable that you have to create this fiction in your mind that maybe she might not have in order to try to absolve yourself of any sense of responsibility? The fact is that I am alive today because of pro-life leaders, voters, legislators, activists, in Michigan, who, without even knowing of my exact existence, yet recognized that mine was a life worth saving. And they made sure that abortion was illegal, even in cases of rape. (laughs) 100% pro-life, no exceptions, no compromise. They are my heroes. And I owe my life to them. And that is why I, in turn, do the same for others. I tell people, if your mother chose life for you, how nice for you. But mine didn't. She chose abortion. Pro-life activists chose life for me. And some of us are in need of heroes. And Michigan, by the way, since their law was passed in 1846, has never had a rape exception. Then every now and then I speak on university campuses, someone will raise their hand during Q&A and say, yeah, I just want to say that I have no problem looking you in the eyes and saying to you that I think that your mother should have been able to abort you, and I fully understand that that would mean that you'd be dead right now. Yeah, I just want to say I have no problem doing that. Wow, okay, well, here you go, everybody. Here's somebody who, out of their care for women, that they would say such a thing to a woman like me. Can you feel how much they care about women? Because I'm not feeling it. And that's the thing. They always act like they care so much about women. Well, I'm a woman. And I challenge them, tell me, what good is my right to a woman for anything if I don't have my right to life? And they can't answer that question because everything else is worthless if you don't have your right to life. Then I'd have some people say, oh, you were lucky. And I explain this has nothing to do with luck. It's decisions that were made, choices we all make every day, whether we get involved, how we vote, whether you compromise and you accept the rape exception. And what a cop-out to suggest that all of our brothers and sisters who are being aborted every day are just somehow unlucky. My birth mother actually went to two back alley abortionists, and I was almost aborted. For the first, she said it was a typical back alley conditions that you hear about as to why she should have been able to safely and legally abort me. Blood and dirt on the floor and on the tables. And those back alley conditions and the fact that it was illegal caused her to back out, as it did with most women. And then she got hooked up with a more expensive abortionist, once again through the rape counselor that the police had referred her to. She said there were no pregnancy resource centers back then, but if there had been, she would have gone. And this time she was to meet someone at night by the Detroit Institute of Arts, ironically next to the Thinker statue. Someone would approach her, say her name, blindfold her, put her in the back seat of a car, then take her and abort me, then blindfold her again and drop her back off. I think it's just so pathetic to know that there are people out there who would hear me describe those conditions and their response would just be, oh, like, it's just so awful that your birth mother should have had to go through all of that in order to have been able to abort you. Like, that's compassionate? Because I understand that they think that they're being compassionate. But that's pretty cold-hearted from where I stand, don't you think? Because that is my life that they're so callously talking about. She's okay. Life went on for her, but I would have been killed through this brutal abortion. I may not look the same as I did when I was 4 years old or 4 days old, yet unborn in my mother's womb, but that was still undeniably me, and I would have been killed. Well, the night that she was to abort me, she was prepared to go through with it. My aunt was to drive her. She spoke with this abortion doctor on the phone, expressed concern for her safety. He called her stupid. And she said, you're going to call me names? All right, just forget it. Then he went on to swear at her profusely, and she finally just hung up the phone. He called her back the next day to try to once again talk her into allowing him to take my life for $500. And the same conversation took place. I cannot even tell you what it feels like to know that somebody wanted to take my life so badly that he would even call back the next day. For some people, their near-death experience is waking up out of a coma to find out that they were almost killed in an automobile accident. For me, this is my near-death experience. And the fact that I was younger doesn't make it any less real or any less significant. I wasn't lucky. I was protected. Legality matters. And a lot of well-meaning Christians would say to me, oh, well, you see, God really meant for you to be here. And I am so thankful that my life was spared. But it's not like I can stand up here and say, oh, well, I deserved it. Look what I've done with my life. And millions of others didn't. I can't do that. I've had people say, oh, look at her, you know, and like online, people show me these conversations and, oh, please don't do that. I just can't even. People just think they have the freedom to be more cruel than they would otherwise be to your face, you know, online. And but they'll say, oh, look at her. She talks all about me, 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 like as if, you know, the world revolves around her and the world couldn't, you know, continue if she weren't here. And she, look how selfish she is. And I think, wow, you know, the most selfish thing to do would be to stay silent and just live my life. You know, too bad for the rest of you. And I feel like my life was saved from a burning building. And as I have the opportunity to go back and save others, and in this country, it's at no risk to my own life, oh, I'm going to do it. And that brings me actually to now the burning building analogy. through so much of the pro-life movement, we hear this slogan, you save the 99 in exchange for the one. It's the burning building analogy. You know, wouldn't you save the 99 in exchange for the one? You save as many as you can while working to save all. And my response is, really? Tell me what you're doing to work to save all. Well, first of all, when I hear the 99 and the one, the first thing I think of is the parable of the lost sheep. Because Jesus was all about saving the one. Who in today's society are the least of these? He said, your Father in heaven, when talking about the little children, he said, your Father in heaven is not willing that any of these should be lost. And in today's society, the least of these are clearly all of those that you hear as the hard cases. You know what I think they're the hard cases? Are all those hardened hearts who can't recognize the value of every life. Those are the hard cases, not us. How unfair to demonize, stigmatize, marginalize children who are conceived in rape. According to the CDC, there's 32,100 some rape-related pregnancies in the United States every year. People assume that, you know, 90, 95% would want to abort. It's the opposite. Two studies, Victims and Victors, Dr. David Reardon from Elliott Institute details this. It's between 15 to 25%. So that is about 25, 27,000 born in the U.S. every year. You look at the birth rate last year, that is 0.67% of the population. Rounded up, that is 1% of the population. We're not just 1% of all abortions. We're 1% of the populations. And you're going to demonize all these children? I've heard it all. You know, a demon spawn, the rapist baby. Okay, I am not the rapist baby. I am my mother's child. I am a child of God. And the majority of rape victims not only choose life, but they're parenting their child. And after everything she's been through, you're actually going to suggest that her child is the rapist baby? Well, in Michigan, the Parentage Act used to be called the Paternity Act, and the legal term of art is a child born out of wedlock. Well, before that, it was called the Illegitimacy Act, and the term of art was illegitimate child. But before that, in the 30s, it was called the Bastard Act. And the legal term of art was bastard. Well, you know what? Jesus fit that definition. But we don't do that to children. We don't stigmatize children like that. It is not right. And when they sit there and say, well, don't you think it's a bit extreme to tell a rape victim she should be forced to carry the rapist baby? Look, let me tell you, I think it's extreme to tell another living human being that they're garbage, that they don't deserve to be living, that they weren't worthy of protection. They are the ones who are being extreme. And we need to be prepared to point that out. So then the other part of the slogan, you know, the save the 99 for the one, they talk about the burning building analogy. And the other part of it that I explain to people is that, you know, tell me what you're doing, because all I see is that you turn off the water, you send the fire trucks home, and you're standing there watching the building burn down with the one inside of it. Tell me what you're doing to work to save all, because I don't see it. We have had the Hyde Amendment in place with the exceptions for 2 decades now. And when do you ever hear anyone talk about going back to save the one? The only time I've ever heard it is actually in Ohio. I testified on the preferred childbirth over abortion legislation, like, I don't know, about 10, 12 years ago, because Ohio Right to Life actually made the effort to try to go back to save the one. That is the only time I've ever heard of that happening. So kudos to you for doing that. But now what is your strategy? See, in Michigan, for years, Michigan Right to Life was the only national Right to Life affiliate for years who would not compromise on this. You could not get their PAC endorsement if you made the rape exception. Period. And they've now mentored other states like Georgia Right to Life, South Dakota Right to Life, Alaska, Tennessee, who have now gone to this model. Many states have gone to this model of no exceptions, no compromise. And that means you don't get their PAC endorsement, especially in the primaries. There's no reason why you can't stand on that in the primaries. And they will not put their stamp of approval on that legislation. So people say to me, pro-life leaders will say to me, well, you know, what did you expect Hyde to do? You know, we could have, look at how many lives were saved. And they act like it's now or never. And what happened in Michigan is when they had the state ban on Medicaid funding of abortion, and they did not have the votes to pass it without a rape exception, Right to Life of Michigan said, okay, don't present it yet. Let's wait. And they worked on those legislators that session, all of the exceptions legislators. They brought in people like me who, this is way back before I even knew how I was conceived. They brought in other people who were conceived in rape, and they worked on these legislators, and they changed some hearts and minds, but not enough. They still did not have the votes. And they told their people, do not introduce this. Hold off. They targeted the rape exception candidates in their primaries. They got enough of them voted out, and the next legislative session, they passed it with no exceptions. That is how you get it done. And there's this debate within the pro-life movement. People will say, well, you know, oh, but we're pragmatists. Well, Dan Becker from Georgia Right to Life wrote a book on personhood, pragmatic guide to pro-life success in the future, something like that. But he talks about how 10 years before he wrote the book was 3 years ago, 10 years before he wrote the book, they were ranked 50th by Americans United for Life, having no pro-life legislation passed. They were the worst in the country. And they went to this model of no exceptions, no compromise. And they were told by Democratic Party, Republican Party, you guys are dead. You're done in this state. You are a bunch of wackos. You're finished. You're irrelevant. You've gone extreme. That's it. And they said, well, okay, we're going to stand on principle. You know, what do we have to lose? They're 50th. You can't get any worse. And so it was easy for them to say, well, let's try it. And they only had one or two legislators who were 100% pro-life. 10 years later, when he wrote the book, every single statewide elected official was 100% pro-life, no exceptions, no compromise. The governor, lieutenant governor, secretary of state, attorney general, all of them, they finally had a majority. Last year, they were ranked second by Americans United for Life, and they had a gold star rating. And that doesn't just happen. It was leadership. It was all about leadership. And they lost a bunch of more board members over this who said, yeah, we're not going extreme like that. And God honored that. God's not going to honor mediocrity. And people act like this is just so insurmountable. That, oh, it's just so hard to change people's minds on the rape issue. Really? I find it, like, actually pretty easy. You know, especially when you put faces to the issue. When I was at the premiere of the Gift of Life film with Governor Mike Huckabee in December of 2011, there were four presidential candidates that spoke at that premiere: Bachman, Santorum, Perry, and Gingrich. I had backstage passes, introduced myself to each, told them that I'm in the film, that I'm national spokeswoman for Personhood USA. Right away, Santorum and Bachman said, oh, I signed the Personhood Pledge. No exceptions, no compromise pledge. They signed it 2 days before the day it came out. I said, yes, I know. Thank you so much. Perry and Gingrich had not, because I knew they were rape exception candidates. And I gave them my DVDs, Accepting Cases of Rape, 12 Stories of Survival, and my story, Conceived in Rape, From Worthless to Priceless. And right away, Perry was stunned. He said, this is your story? And I shared with him some of what I told you. And he said, he asked, can I have your autograph? No. And he said, no, I mean it. And he ripped off the cellophane, popped out the DVD, handed me a marker, and said, here, make it out to my daughter. So I wrote, 100% pro-life, Rebecca Kiesling. And he asked me some questions. I told him about some of the cases I had litigated as a pro-life attorney, pro bono cases that were national, international news, and how I host all these stories on my website and, you know, the speaking that I do. And he said, you know, you're my heroine. I said, oh, thank you so much. But it's funny you say that. Because my question for you is, would you be my hero? And he said, yes, I would. But you make that rape exception. And he put his head down, he shook his head, and he said, wow, this is so powerful. And he was thinking about it. I said, I want to get my picture with you, but my battery's dead. And he said, well, I'm my own personal photographer. Come with me. So we went back in his green room, took a ton of pictures, and he kept looking at them saying, I just can't imagine. I just can't imagine. And I looked up at him and explained, when you make that rape exception, that's like saying to me that I deserve the death penalty for the crimes of my father. The Supreme Court has said, he didn't even deserve the death penalty. There's no death penalty for rapists, even child molesters. And he was nodding his head. And I asked, but you believe that I, the innocent child, deserve the death penalty? He said, no, I don't. I'm like, well, he stopped me. He said, tonight's event and this film are supposed to be all about changing hearts and minds. And right now, you're changing my heart. And I thought, changing? I had all kinds of friends tell me that they were praying for me, and they kept telling me, you're going to have an Esther moment. I just know it. You're going to have an Esther moment, you know, for such a time as this, right? And I was not about to miss it. So I challenged him. No more rape exceptions. And he looked me in the eyes, and he promised, no more rape exceptions. And I thought, yes. He went on to say that he had just never put a face to the issue before. He had never considered it from the perspective of someone like me. He's the governor of Texas. You think he's never heard the arguments before? But again, it shows what putting a face to the issue can do. And let me tell you. Oh, the next morning, by the way, he signed the personhood pledge, and so did Gingrich. And then he went on national news like four times. He was asked about this. How could you sign this pledge? You know, isn't that extreme? And, you know, aren't you an exceptions candidate? And he didn't have any kind of flubs. You know, we have people saying, oh, Republican Party and conservative pundits are saying we need to put this issue behind us, you know, even though it's part of the party platform, but we need to put this issue behind us. And, you know, like it's a losing issue. It's a wedge issue. Quit talking about it. And he wasn't chastised. He wasn't demonized in public, because what did he say? He said, he shared about our conversation, and he just said that I could not look Rebecca in the eyes and justify the rape exception any longer. How's anyone going to argue with that? Back to the issue of compromise real quick. People talk about, like, again, that, you know, just sometimes we need to do this. And first of all, if you had to write a check out of your checkbook, or you had to pay cash for one child to be aborted, and their child was, I know Ryan's here somewhere, I saw him rock, and that child's name was Ryan Baumberger. Okay? You pay for his death and you'll save 99. Would you write that check? That's what you're doing with your taxes. It's exactly what you're doing, but people don't feel like it. They feel like it's so far removed that it's not real money. But it is. It's the same thing. And I don't think that you'd be able to do that. I think you would find some other way to work this out. And let me tell you, if there was ever an exception brought, well, except in cases of biracial rape. You save the 999 in exchange for the one. And you'd hear these arguments. Well, you have to understand, in the case of biracial rape, that the child would look more like the rapist and would be more of a reminder of the rape. I have actually heard those arguments before. Can you imagine the national outrage? Civil rights leaders coming out, how dare you discriminate? And yet so many people think nothing of discriminating against children conceived in rape. And let me tell you, we are not cannon fodder. You do not get to put us out on the front lines and then take a giant step back. You don't discriminate, you don't marginalize, you don't demonize. My birth mother, I was raised in a very abusive family. And my dad broke my nose in high school. My mom was bipolar, undiagnosed, unmedicated for years. Very abusive situation. My brother was in and out of jail and prison. Extremely abusive as well. And things got really ugly over the last several years. And so 2 years ago, 22 years from the day we met on her birthday, my birth mother and her husband legally adopted me. And we love adoption. We're very pro-adoption, but mine was just a very different situation. But it was God once again showing himself in my life to be a father to the fatherless when I had been utterly forsaken. And for me, that is my fairy tale ending. You see, the truth is that I am a blessing to my birth mother. I honor her and I bring her healing. When you can say that you are, one of the greatest things that I've learned really is that the rapist is not my creator. As some people would have me believe, my value and identity are not established as being a product of rape, but a child of God. And we're told, though my mother and father forsake me, the Lord will receive me. And a father to the fatherless is God in his holy dwelling. God sets the lonely in families. And we're told in the New Testament that it's in the spirit of adoption that we're all called to be God's children through Christ our Lord. And I know, and I can teach my children, that if you want to know what your value is, you don't have to prove your worth to anyone. But really all you have to do is look to the cross. Because that is the infinite price that he paid for your lives. And he thought that I was pretty valuable, not worthless, but priceless. And I hope that you all know your own worth. When you can say that you are pro-life without exception, it's like saying, I get it. You matter. Yours was a life worth saving. And I know, I hope now that you will take the opportunity to go forward from here, do the same for others, no exceptions, no compromise. Thank you.
Okay. Have you ever planned to go to President Obama and challenge him?
Yeah, don't I wish. I have, like Governor Snyder in Michigan. He just signed, he signed one pro-life bill, the omnibus bill, and he vetoed another, which was the opt-out of, Obamacare for the abortion coverage in Michigan. And he vetoed it because it didn't have a rape exception. And I did approach him. I also had a conversation with Romney. Like 5 years ago, and he wasn't as tender-hearted. But he actually said to me, so was my wife. And I said, your wife was conceived in rape? He said, no, my wife was almost aborted. And he said, I'm pro-life. And he walked away. And I was just stunned. And I had never heard that story before, and I've never heard it since. But he really did say that to me. So I don't know what to make of it.
Okay. What would you say to students in a Catholic group who are involved in Relay for Life, it looks like, that supports embryonic stem cell research?
Oh, the Relay for, is that the Relay for Life? That's like not a pro-life one. That's more for like cancer research or like,
okay,
right?
But they support.
Oh, Susan G. Coleman.
Yeah. Pull your money from them. I'm sorry, I'm not answering for you. Go ahead.
I boycott anything that, and there's so many things. It's more than just them, but, you know, March of Dimes. People need to be aware, you know, what the cure is. And, you got to watch where you put your money. And we need to raise awareness.
Oh, many of them just comments that you might want to take with you to encourage you. Is it true that studies show that rape mothers don't bond with their children?
Not at all. Not at all. It's the opposite. Shauna Pruitt, who's a member of our organization, we also co-founded, besides Save the One, there's now also hopeafterrapeconception.org. And we met on her campus because of Georgetown Law School. She went to law school because of what was done to her. She had to fight her rapist for custody. And so did a bunch of our board members. Mm-hmm. Or they had to give up their right to prosecution to consent to an adoption, for them to choose adoption. And for him to not fight for custody, you know, they use this as a tactic to get them to drop the prosecution. But she wrote this very important piece for the Georgetown Bar Review, and it's the rights of men who father through rape. And she, it's so well documented, but she talks about how this rhetoric of how a rape victim would feel really hurts the majority of rape victims who are choosing life and choosing to raise their child, because the rhetoric suggests that, you know, they can't bond with their children and that a true rape victim couldn't possibly love the rapist baby. A true rape victim needs an abortion. And so it casts doubt on her story, and so they're left unprotected in the law. Right now, there's not a single state that properly protects rape victims and their children from the rapist having rights. There's just less than a couple dozen that have passed legislation, but it requires a rape conviction. When the standard for termination of parental rights cases is not beyond a reasonable doubt, the criminal standard, the Supreme Court has said it's supposed to be clear and convincing evidence. So why do you create a higher standard for rape victims to be protected from the rapists? Mm-hmm. So we have our model legislation there. And but she, that piece is so excellent. Her name's Shauna Pruitt. And it really explains that this is not at all the case, but people just assume that they can't bond with their children, and that's not based on fact.
My, we are getting so much from you. And one, wanted to know about current legislation you're working on, but at the same time, I'm seeing that we need to wrap this up. So why don't you give people your website and make sure you visit her table. You have a table and information DVD available here.
Yeah, there's
at the
three
conference.
DVDs. The okay. Gift of Life one is 20, but the others are 10. And I have our cards from Save the One, and there's the Heritage House pamphlet of my story is up there too.
Oh, that's right. Oh, I'm sorry. I don't mean to interrupt. Molly's telling me at the same time, and the rest of these questions will be answered on her radio program. But go ahead and explain. Okay. Did you finish your explanation?
Well, like I said, we're working. We want to remove rape exceptions from the law. And we're also working on, you know, testifying all across the country on personhood measures or on abortion bans. And we have so many legislators where they think they don't have enough votes to get out of committee. Not only do we have enough votes that the exceptions legislators change their mind, but also I've had pro-choice legislators completely change their mind and vote to support complete abortion bans after hearing me testify. So, again, it's not insurmountable. Pam Stenzel just testified in North Dakota. And they're going to pass it, I think, this week coming up, some amazing legislation, not just personhood, but also heartbeat and pain-capable legislation. All of it's getting passed because, again, even though North Dakota Right to Life wasn't, personhood and another pro-life organization targeted the rape exception candidates. There were five of them in the Senate. And one of them died in a car accident, tragically, in Alaska, but the other four all got voted out. And so these legislators all knew that if they compromise on the rape exception, they're going to be targeted and they will be gone. And so they were chomping at the bit. They couldn't wait to vote for pro-life measures.
You have been listening to Rebecca Kiesling, attorney and 2013 Bringing America Back to Life Symposium speaker.